Liz is watching me. I don't dare to open my eyes more than a sliver, but under cover of tossing in my sleep, I move my head a little, letting my eyelids flicker. And I can see her, lying there, staring unblinkingly into the darkness. With her glasses off, she looks quite different. The owlish, impenetrable look is gone, and she looks younger. But at the same time, there is something even more unsettling about her blank, unwavering stare. When I close my eyes and settle back down with a little fake snore, I can sense her gaze boring into me. I feel lightheaded with fear. What am I going to do? I try to force myself to breathe slowly, to think this through clearly. Am I in danger? Immediate danger? I don't know. If I am right, Liz has killed 3 people. But I don't think she is killing for fun. I still have no idea why Ava had to die, but Annie and Elliot were only killed when they had concrete information about Liz's guilt. If I can keep my suspicions under wraps until morning, I may be okay. I squeeze my eyes shut, and I think about Elliot's phone, plugged back into the battery upstairs with the text message I sent to Danny in the outbox, waiting for a thread of connection. SOS, please send help. It's Liz. A message I composed with trembling fingers, trying to walk the fine line between a message Danny would understand, a message that would act as a clue if something happens to me before morning, and a message that I could plausibly explain away if Liz somehow stumbles upon it. I don't think she has access to Elliot's phone, but I don't know. That's the problem. I don't know anything. She was doing something up there when she claimed to be going to the toilet. She spent much too long in her room, and I could hear her pacing around, opening and closing doors. She walked into the loo and immediately flushed it without even closing the door, as far as I could tell, let alone sitting on the toilet. She knows something. She suspects something. I just don't know what. All I know is that Annie was killed in her sleep. And so I don't dare to let myself drift off. Liz, Snoop ID Anon 101, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1. Erin knows. I was not sure at first, but as the time stretches out into what feels increasingly like an endless night, I am sure of it. Because in spite of what I first assumed, she is not asleep. She is pretending to be asleep, but she is not. She is lying there with her eyes closed, and every now and again when she thinks I am not watching, she opens her eyes just the smallest slit to check if I am still awake. I see the glint of moonlight between her lashes, and then she squeezes them shut again and does a little fake snore. It's so unfair. God, it's so unfair. I never asked for this. I never wanted any of it. I just wanted to be left alone. It is all I've ever wanted. It's all I wanted from the girls at school with their bitching and their teasing and their prying. It's all I wanted at uni with people badgering me to join up to clubs and attend freshers' formals. It's all I wanted at Snoop. And at first they did. They left me alone. And you know what? It was fine. And then it wasn't. It all unraveled. And that's why I hate them so much. I hate Topher for dragging me into this, for saddling me with these shares like a millstone around my neck. I hate Ava for meddling and meddling and meddling when she should have left well enough alone. I hated her. Are you okay? And is there anything I can do? And we'll make this right, Liz, I swear. I hate Elliot for poking and prying and being too clever by half. I hate Rick for just being one of them, so entitled, so slick, swimming with sharks and never getting hurt because he's one of them. Because he's a man and a public school boy and so very, very charming. And now I hate Erin too. Lying there with her fake little snores and her half smile, when all the time she has been putting two and two together. Only it is too late. What can I do? If only I had been sure of this earlier. I still have 8 of Ava's sleeping tablets in my pocket. It would have been possible, not easy, but possible, to slip them into the cassolet. I could have swapped our plates when Erin wasn't looking. Now it is too late. Though perhaps that has already occurred to her. Perhaps that was what she was really doing in the toilet, when she took so long and came up with that transparent food poisoning story. Perhaps she was making herself sick. Could I stage a break-in? Perhaps I could pretend that Inigo came back for us. It could work. But not if Inigo himself has an alibi. And the problem is that if Inigo does have an alibi and if Erin doesn't suspect me, then I would be exposing myself for no reason. I would be shooting myself in the foot. I have to be very, very careful. I cannot afford a mistake. But I have to know. I have to know what she knows.
Erin, I whisper very quietly. There is complete silence, but it is not quite the silence of someone fully asleep. It is more like the silence of someone thinking it over. At last there is a sigh and Erin says, "Yes?"
"You're still awake?"
"I can't sleep. I keep thinking about the others, wondering where they are."
"It could be true. But then I think about that little slit of her eye glinting at me in the dark.
I don't think it is. I don't think that is what is keeping her awake. I play along.
"Are you worried about Danny?"
There is another long pause. I think she is trying to work out what to say. She is trying to figure out whether she needs to pretend to suspect someone else. "A bit," she says at last.
"I hoped he'd come back tonight, you know."
I am about to say something else. I'm not sure what, something meaningless about being sure Danny is okay. Only then, in the silence, as I formulate my words, there is a double beep. Very faint and coming from upstairs, but completely unmistakable. It is a sound that sets my pulse racing even before I've completely pinned down what it is. It is the sound of a text message coming through.
Erin, Snoop ID Little My, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 10.
I can tell at once that Liz has hurt. Her whole body goes stiff and alert, and she pushes herself up on her elbow, listening intently. Fuck!
What was that?
She says. My heart is racing. I know bloody well what it was. It was Danny replying to Elliot's text message. It must be. Elliot's is the only phone in the house that still has any charge left on it. There must have been a blip of reception, the same sliver that allowed the notification from Snoop to come through. But I keep my face carefully neutral. I have no idea. It sounded like a phone, don't you think? But that can't be right. Liz is staring at me, like she's trying to figure out what's going on behind my face. Oh my God. She knows. She definitely knows. She just isn't sure enough to act on her suspicions. I have to be very, very careful.
It sounded like it was coming from upstairs,
Liz says. She grabs her glasses and swings one leg out of bed. Yeah. I say it slowly, my mind racing. At all costs, I can't let her get into Elliot's room. If she sees that message, I'm in big trouble. She already suspects me. It would be very hard to explain that message away. Yeah. It did. Could she kill me? I don't know. Her knee is as screwed as my ankle. Could she out-hobble me if it came to trying to get away? I am trying to think of a plan. Could I lure her outside somehow? Lock the door? But then I think of Danny's words about Inigo turning up, begging to be let in, and I know he was right. I could never stand there and watch another human being freeze to death inches away, only a pane of glass separating us. I just couldn't. Not even Liz. But I can't let her find that text message. My mind is racing, trying to remember what I could see on Elliot's lock screen before I cleared it. Some people have their text messages show up in their entirety. Others only have the idea of the sender or just, you have a text. Which is Elliot? Why didn't I check before I unlocked the phone and cleared his notifications? Of course, if it occurs to Liz to use Elliot's dead body to unlock the phone like I did, none of this matters. It sounds like it came from Miranda's room, I say slowly, trying to think how to put her off track.
You think?
Liz says. Her face is sceptical.
I thought it sounded more like Elliot's. It'd be just like him to have some kind of super long charge battery.
My stomach flips. Of course. Of course she's right. She knows these people. And now I realise I'm trapped. I can't suggest we split up and I check Elliot's room when I already said I think the sound came from Miranda's. I will have to go along with her suggestion.
Should we go and check?
I try to look doubtful. It seems a bit disrespectful. Maybe we should rule out the other rooms first. Liz swings the other leg out of bed. She looks decisive.
I think it's more important that we get to the phone while it still has reception,
she says reasonably, and I can't find a way of contradicting her because the thing is, she's right. That's exactly what I'd be saying too if I hadn't sent that fucking text.
I understand if you don't want to come,
she adds. I waver. It's tempting, but I can't let her go up there alone. That would be worse. There may be some way I can get to the phone before she does, delete Danny's reply.
Of course,
I say instead, like I'm steeling myself to do something necessary. Of course, you're right, I was just being squeamish. It's more important to get word out. Anyway, the door will be locked. You'll need my key.
Of course,
she echoes. And for a second, just a second, her hand strays towards her pocket, where the missing passkey must have been hidden, in a totally involuntary gesture that I would have missed if I hadn't been watching her every move. She catches herself before her hand makes contact, so that it just looks like she's adjusting her ski suit. But I know what she was thinking. As we make our way up the stairs, I have a sharp, piercing sense of déjà vu. The number of times we have crept up these stairs in daylight or in darkness to some horrible discovery. Only this time, I know what lies at the top of them, and I am the one who is fearing exposure. My heart is racing as we reach Elliot's door, and when I reach into my pocket for the passkey, I find my hand is shaking.
Are you okay?
Liz says. She has put her glasses back on, and they glitter in the darkness.
You don't have to come in if you don't want.
I'm fine, I say through gritted teeth. Just cold. And then I turn the key, and we are inside Elliot's room. The stench of death somehow even worse than before, though I know logically that cannot be the case. Not in the few hours since I was last here. Liz gags and puts her hand over her mouth, and her action gives me an excuse. The battery block is down the side of the desk, hidden from the door. If I can get her to concentrate on the far side of the room... The smell's pretty bad, I say. If you want to concentrate on the bedside of the room, I can take the desk. She nods and moves over to the other side of the room. I am busy going through the motions, opening drawers, pretending to search for a phone I know full well is just out of sight, when I hear something. And then...
Erin.
I look up, look towards the bed, but she's not there. She has come up behind me. And she has found the phone. My heart starts beating so loudly. I am sure that Liz will be able to hear. Run, run, run! A voice in my ear is screaming, but I don't. I hold very still. Maybe I can still talk my way out of this. What does it say? What does it say? I wish I could see the lock screen, but I can't. Liz is holding the phone in her hand, angling it towards her so that all I can see is the light from the screen reflecting off her glasses.
That sound,
she says very slowly. She looks up at me, a frown furrowed between the lenses of her spectacles.
It was a text message. And it was to you.
Liz. Snoop ID Anon 101. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers 1.
I stare down at the screen and then up at Erin's blank face. This doesn't make sense. Or does it? Messages, says the lock screen, and then a little preview pane showing the first line of the message. Fuck. Erin, is that you? Erin is looking at me like a rabbit in a snare. Elliot's phone is a thumb lock. It makes what I have to do next very easy. I reach out and grab his cold, heavy hand.
No!
Erin yelps, and she reaches for the phone, but it is too late. I am in. S.O.S., I read, feeling fury,
begin to kindle inside me, making my cheeks hot. Please send help. It's Liz. I stare up at Erin, looking her right in the eye, feeling my jaw fall open with shocked betrayal. That bitch. That total bitch.
Erin. Snoop ID, Little Mai. Listening to Offline. Snoop Scribers, 10.
I see Liz's face change as she reads it, and I know, instantly, there is no way of explaining my way out of this. Her face goes white, and she stays very, very still. But I don't think it's fear that's paralyzing her. I think it might be something else. I think it might be anger.
You don't understand, I say weakly, but my voice is croaky, and I know there is no point in this. I don't know how I ever thought that text was ambiguous. Seeing Liz's face, I understand now. There is only one way for her to take it.
You know, she says, and her voice is horribly calm.
I want her to scream and shout. Anything would be better than this icy chill.
But there's a kind of relief in her words, because now I can stop pretending. I can stop this horrible dance of does she know I know she knows, and just face up to the truth.
Yes, I know, I say quietly. And then I take a step backwards and I sink down on Elliot's bed and put my face in my hands. Partly because my ankle is killing me and the pain is starting to make me feel sick. And partly because my legs are shaking so hard I can't stand anymore.
She stands there, looking down at me, her face blank and unreadable behind those huge glasses. The light from Elliot's phone gives her face an eerie, uplit glow. Behind her, Elliot, the man she killed, lies sprawled across his desk, a terrifyingly immediate reminder of what she has done to protect her secret. The secret I now have. Oh, God. What have I done? Danny, where are you?
God. He stinks,
she says at last, wrinkling up her face. She cracks her knuckles, click, click, click. But it no longer sounds nervy. It sounds like someone limbering up for a fight.
Let's get out of here. Come downstairs and we can talk this through.
As if in a dream, or maybe a nightmare, I follow her out of the room. She holds the phone out in front of her like a candle illuminating the corridor. And when we get to the top of the stairs, she says,
After you.
I hesitate. I don't want to make her angry, but at the same time, there is no way I am going down that slippery, precarious staircase with her at my back. I'm just not. Liz sees my hesitation and gives a mirthless laugh.
Okay, I don't blame you. I'll go first. But you keep a step back, okay? I'm not having you pushing me down the steps either.
I nod. I don't mind keeping my distance. It would be almost as easy for her to snatch my ankle out from underneath me as it would be for me to kick her in the small of the back.
God, This is surreal. I watch her as she makes her way carefully down the stairs, holding the handrail, the phone guiding the way like a faint will-o'-the-wisp. Downstairs, she moves away from the foot of the stairs and feeds another log into the burner, making it flare so that the room is bright with its glow. And I hurry down while her back is turned, my heart beating quicker until I am on solid ground. Then she straightens up and shuts the glass door of the stove. I am alone with a murderer. I am alone with a murderer. Maybe if I keep repeating the words to myself, it will start to feel real.
Liz, Snoop ID Anon 101, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1.
In a way, it is a relief to have it out in the open. I could tell there was something wrong, and I have always hated trying to read between the lines, second-guessing myself, attempting to parse a frown or a blank look or a pause that might be something or might be nothing. Now, we both know where we are, which is a relief, but it is also a problem. Because I liked Erin. No, that's wrong. I shouldn't be using the past tense. Not yet. I like her. I actually do really like her. I don't want to have to do this. But she did something really, really stupid when she sent that text. And now I have no choice. She's forced my hand, really. If anything, this is her fault. The sense of injustice boils up again. This is so unfair. I never wanted any of this, you know, I say to her as she sinks down onto one of the chairs, staring into the flames. She is shaking. I'm not sure if it's cold or shock. What? She looks up. And I feel anger bubble up inside me, and then push it back down. Has she even been listening? I said, I never wanted this. I sink down into the armchair opposite her. I stare at the fire, feeling its heat on my face. I would never have killed any of them if I could help it. I'm just as much of a victim here. She blinks, and for a minute it looks like she's going to say something, but then she seems to think better of it. Tell me about it, she says. And so I do.
Erin, Snoop ID, Little Mai. Listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers, 10.
I am lost in thought as Liz sits down opposite me. And I suddenly realise she is talking. What she is saying doesn't make sense. Some nonsense about her being the real victim in all of this. I look up and I meet her eyes, and I am overwhelmed with the urge to slap her, to shake her, to scream, "You? Are you kidding me? What about Ava? What about Elliot? What about fucking Annie, who never harmed a fly?" But I don't, because I suddenly realise what I have to do here. I have to humour her. I have to keep her talking long enough for Danny to get back here with reinforcements. He has seen the text. He knows what it means. He will be doing everything he can to help me. I don't know what time it is, but it must be way after midnight. If I can just keep Liz talking long enough, I may be able to survive this. I may even be able to get justice for all the people she has killed.
Because I am a survivor. That's what Liz doesn't know about me. She sees a soft, posh girl from the same background as Topher and Ava, someone who has never had to work for her living, to scrap for survival. But that's not true. Not in my case. In spite of my family name, I didn't grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth. Not in the way Topher and Ava did. I've always known that I was second best and that I would have to fight for myself. I know what it's like to clean up other people's mess for a living. But more than that, the most important thing about me, something Liz will never understand, could never understand unless she had stood in my shoes. I looked death in the face once, and I turned him away. I can do it again. Tell me about it, I say. There is a catch in my throat, and my voice is shaking with the effort of keeping it calm when I feel anything but. But Liz doesn't seem to notice. Instead, she smiles. Incredibly, unbelievably, she smiles. And she begins to speak. Liz, Snoop ID, Anon 101, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1.
You don't know what it was like, starting at Snoop, I say. It is easier not to look at Erin while I'm telling her this, so I look away again, into the fire. Remembering that first day, opening the office door and seeing them all, lounging around inside, laughing, bantering, so effortlessly, searingly cool. It was like walking into a different world, like something off the TV where people were sleek and beautiful and witty. They were like a different species. And I wanted to be them so much. School was so horrible. I can't explain it. I knew I was different from the other girls in my class. I knew they all laughed at me. But somehow I thought when I got to my real life, it would be different. I thought that maybe I was just an ugly duckling. I swallow. It is strange saying all of this, unwrapping secrets I have carried for 3 years. But when I got to Snoop, I realised that wasn't true. I wasn't going to magically grow into a swan overnight. Ava and Topher, even Elliot and Rick in a way, they had been different and special and beautiful right from the day they were born. And I wasn't. I was never going to be a swan. I had to accept that. But the thing is, I was good at my job, really good, and Snoop was doing well, and I cared about it, about them. So when the firm had problems raising money just before the launch, I offered Topher and Ava my grandmother's money. I still remember the shock on their faces when I made the suggestion. I laugh. Remembering Topher's expression when I spoke up in that meeting, as if his office chair had piped up, offering a solution to their finances. I think they realised then that they'd underestimated me, that the girl who brought the coffee and took the minutes was a real human being who could understand a profit and loss sheet and figure out when the company was in trouble. It was like they really looked at me for the first time. Ava offered to pay me back with interest, and it was a good rate, too. I would have got back almost half as much again by the time it was all paid back. But Topher took me aside into his office and told me I should ask for shares and hang out until I got them. I knew it was a risk. Rick spelled it out really carefully. I wouldn't see my money back for a long time, and if the firm went under, I'd lose everything. But Topher, you don't know what he's like. He's so charismatic. He makes you feel that you're everything, that he will take care of you, that your money could not be in safer hands. So that's what I went for in the end. I thought at the time that Topher was being generous. I thought he was looking out for me. I stare into the flames, feeling the brightness burning into my retinas, as if it can burn away the memories I have carried with me for years. I didn't know then what I know now, that he had seen how it would pan out in the event of a disagreement and thought I was someone he could pressure in the event of a split. I stop. Suddenly this feels hard in a way I didn't think it would. It is good to spill all of this. Erin is a good listener in some ways, and it feels a little like lancing a boil, letting out all the poison that has festered away since that night. But it hurts, too. And when I swallow against the pain, my throat is dry. The sensation gives me an idea. Shall I make some tea? I ask. Sorry? Erin says. There is an incredulous note in her voice. I can't quite blame her. The question must have sounded slightly surreal in the midst of all this. Tea, I say. I don't know about you, but I'm really thirsty. Tea? Erin echoes, like someone speaking in a foreign language, and then she gives a shaky laugh. Tea would actually be great. It's exactly what I need right now. We get up and limp together into the kitchen, where I find two cups, and Erin fetches the stovetop kettle and a packet of tea bags. There's no milk, I'm afraid, she says as she puts the kettle under the tap. It went off yesterday. We both stand there, waiting for the kettle to fill. But there is no sound of rushing water, and then I remember I can see from the sudden look of comprehension on Erin's face that she is remembered too. The pipes, she says unnecessarily. I nod. Should we get snow? I ask. I guess, Erin says. But I can hear from the hesitation in her voice that she doesn't want to go outside. I can't say I exactly blame her. I don't really want to go out either. We both know that stepping outside the chalet would give the other person the chance to lock us out, where we would very likely freeze to death. But the snow is piled up against the front door, so if we do this right, neither of us needs to go outside. If you open the front door, I say, and stand there with the kettle, I can chip bits off the drift by the door. She nods, and I can see from her expression that she is grateful that I have taken on the more precarious role. The snow is piled up so high that you have to climb over the drift to get out, so it's fairly unlikely someone could just push you out of the door, but it is still possible. Thanks, she says, and together we troop through into the foyer, where Erin unlocks the bowing front door. I begin to dig at the hard-packed snow with a spoon, chipping off lumps and putting them into the kettle Erin is holding out. At last, we're both shivering with cold. But the kettle is full, and we shut the door and return to the living room and the blazing fire, where Erin balances the kettle on the edge of the wood stove, and we both warm up our hands at the glass. You were saying? She prompts as the kettle begins to hiss and sigh. The shares? Her words bring me back with a bump to our present reality. I finger the empty packet of sleeping pills in my pocket. I think about what I have to do.
Erin, Snoop ID, Little Mai, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers, 10.
Finding the kettle, getting the snow, all the little mundane practicalities of making the tea, have let me push our situation to the back of my mind for a moment. But as the silence closes around us, I feel fear settle, like a weight on the back of my neck. Liz is silent, her face blank and unreadable, her hands stuck out to the blaze, and somehow her silence is more terrifying than any speech. I find myself trying to work out what is going through her mind. Is she figuring out a way out of this, or just thinking about what she has done? The kettle hisses softly. Liz just sits there, staring at the kettle, one hand held out to the blaze, the other in her pocket, and suddenly I can't take it anymore. "You were saying?" I blurt out. Liz looks up. She looks at me appraisingly, in a way I don't like. She is crunching a piece of plastic in her pocket. The noise is loud in the silence, and I think if she doesn't say something, I might scream. And then she swallows and picks up her story again.
"The shares."
"Yes. So, yes, there I am. 22, a shareholder in this up-and-coming app. And Topher and Ava start treating me a bit more like a human being now that I'm invested in the business. I mean, I've only got 2%. Even Elliot and Rick dwarf my share, but I am a shareholder. And one night, a few days after we signed the papers, there's this drinks party in this flashy London bar. I can't remember why. I think they were after a partnership with some streaming company, some kind of quid pro quo." She stops. Something is coming, I can tell. I don't know what exactly, but it feels like Liz is gearing herself up for something. Forcing herself on to a part of the story she doesn't want to spell out.
"They had an argument over whether I should go. I remember Rick saying, 'Do you think this is the image we want to project?' He didn't know I was listening, of course. They were in Ava's office and I was listening in via the intercom. And Ava said, 'For fuck's sake, Rick, it's not rocket science. I can make her presentable. And she's one of us on paper now, thanks to Toph, so she might as well look the part.'" Then she paused and said, "Besides, Norland likes her type. He likes them young." So I knew what was going on when Ava got me to come over to her house before the party and offered to lend me a dress, because she knew I was on a budget after pouring all my money into Snoop. When she said it like that, it sounded perfectly reasonable, kind even, but I knew the truth, of course. "Well, you've seen Ava, you know what she's like. There's probably only about 3 women in London who could squeeze into her jeans, but we found something somehow, and Ava made up my face. And when we arrived at the bar and were introduced to the executives from the other company, I don't know, I actually started to feel like a real snooper. Ava introduced me not as her PA, but as Liz, who is a minority shareholder. And they talked to me with respect. And as the evening wore on, I really started to believe this was it. This was the life I had been waiting for. I don't normally drink much, but I drank that night. I drank a lot. A lot of cocktails and...
She stops. The kettle is hissing and bubbling, and she picks it up gingerly by the handle and fills each of the cups, then drops a tea bag in the top. I take the one she hands to me, looking down into it surreptitiously. I don't want to aggravate her suspicions, but given how Elliot died, it would be stupid of me not to check. The melted snow is a little cloudy, and the tea is starting to leach out of the bag and colour the hot water. But I can still see the bottom of the cup, and there's definitely nothing there. No pills, anyway.
And? I prompt, very gently. And then when she looks away, I say, I'm sorry, I don't want to pry. If this is too painful.
No, she says with a rush. It's okay. Honestly, it helps in a weird way, talking about it. I just haven't thought about it in so long. We all got very, very drunk, and somehow, I can't remember how, I ended up going with Ava, with one of the executives from the bar. It was just the three of us. Topher had been going to come, I remember that, because he was in the taxi, but then at the last minute he bailed out and asked the driver to drop him off. We arrived at this house in Pimlico and, my God, it was amazing. It was so beautiful, this Georgian building, stories high, with a balcony right at the top overlooking the river.
She is staring past me now, as if she is looking at something I can't quite see.
He took us upstairs, and we went out onto the balcony, and he gave us champagne, and we chatted for a while. And then Ava excused herself and went to the bathroom. She breaks off, but I don't think it's because she can't go on, not quite. It's because she is trying to work out what to say, how to say it. He tried to assault me, she says at last, bluntly. He had his hands down my top. I was trying to push him away, and I...
She stops. She puts her hands to her face.
I pushed him hard. I pushed him off the balcony.
Oh, my God, I say. Whatever I expected was not this.
Liz, I'm so sorry.
The implications are buzzing in my head, even as I stammer out my pathetically inadequate attempts at sympathy. She killed a man. But it was self-defense. But Liz is still talking, ignoring me, rushing on as if she wants to be past this part of the narrative.
I broke down when I realised what I'd done, but Ava, she was amazing. She came running, and when she saw what had happened, she didn't ask any questions. She just got us both out of there, and when it came out in the paper, it was written up as a tragic accident. There were drugs and alcohol in his system, and people, they just assumed that he fell, I suppose, or that he threw himself over. No one ever mentioned that Ava and I were even there. It just goes to show what money and influence can buy, I guess.
She looks away at that, and then buries her face in her tea so that her glass is mist with steam.
I couldn't stay. After that, she says very quietly, I left Snoop, and I never looked back. I went to work somewhere completely different, a banking call centre. It became like this horrible, nightmarish episode in my life that was done and gone. Until the buyout happened, and I was dragged back into all of this.
I'm so sorry, I say again, and it's true. I am sorry. Sorry for that poor kid dragged into a world she didn't understand. But I still don't completely understand. She was assaulted. She was trying to get away from an attacker, and even if Liz didn't trust the court to believe that, and I can see why she wouldn't, why did Ava have to die? She kept Liz's secret. And then, in a horrible, blinding flash, I get it. Topher was the one who gave Liz those shares, on the tacit understanding that she would back him up if it ever came to a crunch like this. She owed him everything. But Ava, Ava knew something about Liz that could ruin her. At the very least, she would be embroiled in a messy public court case, and I know enough about Liz to know that that would be torture to her. At the worst, she might be looking at a manslaughter charge and prison. Whether she articulated it or not, Ava was the one who covered up what happened. She held that evidence in her hands, and she must have been holding that fact over Liz's head all these years. No wonder Liz could never find the courage to say how she was planning to vote. She could vote to betray her mentor, the man who hired her, stuck up for her, got her the shares in the first place. Or she could vote against the person who held her life in her hands, the person who could send her to prison to rot. When the realization comes, it's with a twisted lurch of sympathy for Liz. I think of that poor young girl, fresh out of university, swimming in waters far too strange and dangerous for her to navigate. Because Liz was the victim of not one horrible situation, but of two. Ava had helped her out of one nightmare, only to create another of her own making, blackmailing the girl she had professed to help. Of course, Liz did the sensible thing. She told Ava that she was voting with her. But what about next time? And the time after that? How could she live her life knowing that Ava had this secret to hold over her head any time she needed something Liz was unwilling to give? No. She needed to make herself safe forever. She needed to get rid of the person who had started all this, the only person who knew her secret. She needed to kill Ava.
Liz, Snoop ID Anon 101, listening to Offline, Snoop Scribers 1.
So, that's it, I say at last. I put my tea to my lips for a long time, pretending to gulp it thirstily down. Erin is staring at me, but I can't tell what her expression is. It looks slightly horrified, but that could be sympathetic horror at what I've been through. Does she believe me? I can't decide. Do you want to drink your tea? I want to ask, but I can't say that. It would sound suspicious. Instead, I raise my cup to my lips again, hoping to convey the message by subliminal suggestion. To my delight, it works. Erin picks up the cup. I see the muscles of her throat work as she swallows.
So you had no choice,
she says faintly. And I try to arrange my face in the expression I think she will expect to see, a kind of pained regret. And it's true. I do regret this. That night, most of all. I never wanted any of this, I say. I just feel like I've been swept up in something awful and horrible. Erin shakes her head.
but not like she is telling me she doesn't believe me. More like she's condemning whatever brought us here. She is staring down into her cup. I can't see her face very well. That bothers me. But then she takes another sip of tea, and I begin to feel more relaxed.
I put my own cup to my lips too, in order not to seem suspicious. I'm careful not to actually swallow any of the liquid inside. I've worked out what you did, Erin says, as she puts the cup on her knees, nursing it with her hands. I can see from where I'm sitting that it's half empty, and I begin to feel more confident.
It was very clever. You had a ski jacket like Ava's. You met her at the top of the lift.
She pauses, and I know why. She's trying not to spell out what I did,
as if it will offend me in some strange way.
But it's okay. I have to live with what happened. There is no point in not facing up to it. I was waiting at the top of the lift when Ava got off, right by the barrier, where I had pretended to lose control and almost ski over the edge with Rick earlier that day.
Of course, I didn't lose control at all.
It was a deliberate slide to give myself the chance to check out the edge up there. I wanted to see if it was as close as I remembered, to see if the barrier had been raised since my last visit 2 years ago. Nothing had changed.
It was perfect.
The irony is, of course, I'm a very good skier. But Topher and Rick and all the others were too willing to believe that a girl from a Crawley comprehensive wouldn't know one end of a ski pole from the other. The truth, had they ever bothered to ask me, is that I loved skiing. Right from the first time I went on a school trip age 15. I had never set foot on a ski slope before, but I remember the teacher saying admiringly, "You're a natural, Liz." And I was. I am not sporty, as a rule. I don't do well with anything that requires teamwork or running in circles. I disliked getting red-faced and sweaty, everything jiggling unpleasantly under a sticky T-shirt while girls shouted at me to pass the ball. "No, not that way. Oh, for God's sake, Liz." Until I wanted to run away and hide from them all. But skiing was different. Skiing is solo and it is strategic. You have to think on your feet, making split-second decisions that could save your life or send you hurtling down a sheer slope at 100 kilometres an hour. I loved it. I managed to go back again during my A-levels and twice at university. The very cheapest trips I could manage. Coach to Bulgaria to stay in a Soviet-era concrete monolith. Ryanair to Romania to a self-catering Airbnb with hot air vents that smelled of ham. But it was worth it. It was worth the scrimping and the saving and the long nights spent crunched into economy coach seats, barreling down German autobahns in the middle of the night. They did a corporate ski trip when I was at Snoop, wooing investors. Of course, they didn't invite me. But since I left Snoop, since I've been earning my own money, I've been back to the Alps every year, sometimes twice. And I have become a very, very good skier. Not quite as good as Ava, who has been skiing every year since she was a toddler, but almost. And I have been to Saint-Antoine twice. I know La Sorcière very well indeed. When she got off the lift, I was over by the barrier.
I called out to her, pretending that I was in some kind of difficulty. And when she skied over, I waited until she was right next to me, bending over, looking at the binding of my boot. And then I gave her an almighty push, toppling her backwards over the shallow safety barrier. The barrier caught her in the back of her knees, and she went down like a skittle and landed in the thick, untouched snow right on the edge of the precipice, her skis windmilling in the air. For a minute, I didn't think it had worked. I thought she was going to stay sprawled on the narrow ledge of snow, crawl her way back to the barrier, ask me what the hell I was playing at. But then there was an imperceptible sound, like a sigh. The snow ledge began to shift and tilt, and a crack appeared at the top. For a second, I saw Ava, frozen in horror, looking up at me, holding out her arms like I was going to be her saviour. And then the whole ledge gave way, and she was gone. I waited for a moment, and then I unzipped my jumpsuit and pulled out the scarlet jacket I was wearing underneath. I put it on over the top of my navy blue ski suit, pulled my scarf up, and settled my goggles over my face. Then turned my skis to face down the run, and I began to ski La Sorcière. I would be lying if I said it wasn't difficult. It was. It twists and turns, full of sheer drops, heart-stopping hairpin bends, and vertical ice sheets where I couldn't do anything but a kind of controlled fall. If I hadn't known the run well, I think it would have killed me. But I have never skied better. I stopped halfway down to catch my breath and wait for the trembling in my legs to subside. And it was then that I saw Carl and Annie travelling high above in the bubble. I looked up, safe in the knowledge that my goggles were pulled up and my hat was pulled down, and that no one could possibly tell who was wearing the distinctive scarlet ski jacket. And I waved my ski pole, establishing my alibi, and Annie saw me and waved back. It was just my luck that she saw something else, too. The empty bubble lifts making their way back to the valley floor. And the bubble lifts that should have been taking me back to Saint-Antoine. I saw the recognition in her eyes that night when she came to my room. I saw her, literally, put two and two together standing there in the doorway, the puzzlement changing to horror as she made her excuses. Suddenly, she didn't want to speak to me anymore. She wanted to get away, figure out what to do. And short of putting a hand over her mouth and dragging her into my room, I couldn't think of any other alternative. So I let her go. I knew then what I had to do. I thanked my lucky stars for Tiger's insomnia and the instinct that had prompted me to pocket the pass key when Danny left it in the door earlier that day. Although, that wasn't luck, really, was it? The truth is, I am not a lucky person. Yes, the Tiger thing went my way, but so much else has gone against me. And the pass key, that wasn't luck. That was me. A split-second decision that looked like it was about to save my skin. Because the thing is, I may not be lucky, but I am good at thinking on my feet. Perhaps that is why I like skiing so much. It is the same skills, the same twisting and turning, the same heart-pounding excitement. The same drop in your stomach when you realise you've made a stupid mistake, and then the same lift of excitement when you realise you can manoeuvre your way out of it.
I felt bad about Annie, though. Bad in a way that I didn't about Elliot. Elliot deserved what happened to him. He didn't have to poke and pry. That was his choice. Annie's choice was no choice at all. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Just like me. And that is a tragedy. But it's not my fault. I have to remember that. None of this is my fault.
What did you say?
Erin asks me, and I realise I must have muttered some of those words aloud. I'm about to answer.